forever. Dog.
Hey folks, it's me, Ben Blacker, the creator and host of The Writers Panel. Thanks for listening. It's 2023. Things are weird. It definitely feels like a storm is coming. Folks are out pitching. Folks are making shows. I'm glad there's some life in this business. But it feels weird out there. People, especially new writers, folks who have just broken in, and people like me, sort of the middle class of writers, are very uncertain. Feels bad. I don't know. I don't have a lot to say about it. I talk about it on these next few episodes of the podcast with my guests who have great perspective. They're all good writers and good people, and I think you'll enjoy these upcoming episodes. I'm writing. I feel like that's the thing to do. You know, at this point, we have a backlog of material, but we're really proud of all of it and would love to find a home for it. But we'll see. We'll see what things look like in the next few months. I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm making a lot of pizza. I got a wok for Christmas. I've been really enjoying that. Not for pizza, for making other food. Those have been giving me great creative satisfaction, even as I hammer away at some scripts that I really want to write. I've also really enjoyed writing this weekly newsletter. I hope you'll check it out. If you don't already, you can find it at benblacker.substack.com. And it's been really fun. I love the little community that's popping up around this newsletter and hearing from the same folks who are breaking into the business or who are in the business in the comments and in my emails and stuff. It's really cool. And I've loved sort of like working stuff out in this newsletter. In January, I wrote all about process. And what the process is, like some real nuts and bolts stuff, what the process is for some established writers I've talked to over the years, and then what my process is. The most fun thing has been the monthly Q&A sessions with professional writers, and it's been just a terrific, like people are coming out for this. It's so much fun. We just had one with the You creator and showrunner Sarah Gamble, who was also my boss at Supernatural. But we had Jane Espenson, Akela Cooper, who wrote Megan and has been on the Star Trek shows, and she's writing a ton of really fun, cool horror movies. Gosh, they've been so enlightening and like getting to, you know, we've had like 10 to 15 subscribers show up to each of these. They're only for paid subscribers of the newsletter. And we've had like 10 or 15 folks show up and everyone's gotten to ask their questions and talk to these pro writers and get advice and sort of connect. So I highly recommend it. I hope you will subscribe to benblacker.substack.com and become a paid subscriber and join these Q&As. You both get the access to these Zoom meetings, but you also get the recordings later if you can't make it. And they're well worth listening to. I'm not going to put any of them out as a podcast for at least a year. And so the only way to hear those and the only way to participate is to become a paid subscriber, benblacker.substack.com. I think it's worth it. I'm maybe biased, but I think it's worth it and I am enjoying doing it. And honestly, I'm learning a lot about my own process and the things I'm concerned about in the industry, even as I write these weekly newsletters. Hopefully you'll get something out of them too. Come by and sample. If you like what you see, become a paid subscriber. It's all really helpful, especially in these uncertain times. Thank you as always for listening. Please enjoy these next few months of shows. I think they're some of the best, some great folks with some really good advice. I really enjoyed talking to all these people.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
this is how a podcast starts. Thank you all so much for being here, for returning to this podcast. What I'm going to do is ask you all to introduce yourselves on the microphones in turn. Tell us some who you are and where the listener may have seen your name on their television or movie screen before. And Liz, our returning pal, please start us off.
Thank you, Ben. My name is Liz Tigelaar. You may have seen my name on Little Fires Everywhere, which I adapted Celeste Ng's book, thanks to Scott's wife, Lauren Neustetter. You may have seen my name on other, you know, more forgettable things too. But my first show was a show called Life Unexpected on the CW a long, long time ago. And there's been a lot of stuff in between.
And your new show?
Oh, and my new show, yes, is Tiny Beautiful Things, adapted from Cheryl Strayed's book of the same name. And that will be on Hulu April 7th.
Terrific.
Also, thanks to Scott's wife, Lauren.
Scott, is your wife there? Can we just bring her in? What is happening?
Every Zoom, somehow she just becomes the focal point of all the Zooms.
Scott, please introduce yourself and tell us where we've seen your name before.
My name is Scott Neustadter. I have written a few movies with my partner, Michael Weber, in the past that you might have seen. 500 Days of Summer is one of them. The Spectacular Now, Fault in Our Stars, The Disaster Artist. And my new show is a television program that I created called Daisy Jones and the Six, based on Taylor Jenkins Reid's novel, also produced by Lauren Neustadter.
Jeez.
Don't feel left out, John.
I know.
It's if I do.
Also, I want to mention Scott Rosaline, which was your film, which I loved.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. on Hulu.
Yes, which I've recommended on this podcast in the past month or so. John and Bob.
John and Bob, that's that is me. Probably I'm most associated with the comedy Party Down that was on Starz, two seasons like 12 years ago, and amazingly now a third season that's just about to drop tomorrow. And then before that, I had worked on iZombie. I did a season of a show, Benched, for USA a while back. And then the first show I worked on was Veronica Mars, and had essentially, that was my first television job, and kind of had been kind of a bumbling feature screenwriter before then.
Well, let's get into Party Down, which is, I think, as of this release, is back on the air.
So excited.
Amazing.
Why now? What's happening? What, how did this come to be? I'm sure you've told the story a lot of times already. So I'll take the short version if you want.
There is no kind of why now, because it was a perpetual why not now for us ever since.
Yeah.
You know, going back to the end of the second season, you know, just the way we were basically the victims, not of kind of failing to do kind of what we had all agreed we wanted to do with the kind of gang at Starz that we set up with. We actually had a great experience with them. Mm-hmm. But then it was a classic regime change, new president, new people came in. I mean, sadly, at our little premiere party it was kind of a little wrap party at the end of the second season. All our little executives showed up and everyone had just gotten fired.
Oh,
so it was a very bittersweet little wrap party we had. But yeah, we had always wanted to do more. We had been planning on doing a third season. We assumed we were going to get one just because the second season went very well. Everyone was happy with what was going on. We were very dialed in. We felt like to kind of making the show of this scale and this style and everything. So just, you know, when we finally met the new guy and we realized what his plans were, we were like, oh dear. And that was, I mean, we were correct. We were kind of out, you know, out with the old and in with the new. So, but we'd been trying ever since to kind of either entice them with new ways to kind of approach it, you know, like, what about now? Maybe you guys want to try some comedy again. What about us? And that sort of thing. So we came at them in various, you know, from various directions, you know, here and there, on and on over the years. And then we actually had a very karmic stroke of good fortune in that there was another regime change. And, you know, the new head of the network was quoted in an interview saying that he, you know, he missed Party Down. He kind of regretted that it went away. And so, you know, our other producer, Rob Thomas, just called him and was just like, you know, we're still here at your service if you feel like it. And, you know, fortunately, we had a very good relationship with all the cast and everything. And we had all, you know, we'd kind of reunited here and there, and we run into each other and we keep in touch and everything. So when this kind of bubbled up, we just were able to kind of say, like, hey, like, would you guys do this if this actually finally materializes? And so it kind of fell together once, you know, that ball got rolling.
It's so interesting. And I want to sort of ask this broadly. We'll zero in on everyone's current projects in a minute, but like, is this the state of the industry right now? Like, are we at, you know, we've always been at the whims of these regime changes and things like that, making the decisions, but is the notion that like consecutive seasons aren't even on the table anymore? And like, if the opportunity arises, either at the same network or at a different network because of a new president or because of a new mandate, like that's what, you know, three seasons looks like now. It's over 10 years or 12 years in your case, John.
To be honest, I feel like it is a very weird time in that regard. You know, certainly when I started out, when there was kind of, you know, the majority of the television work was kind of within the network system, there was a season, everyone was running around in a frenzy in the spring. And, you know, there was kind of a, you know, whatever kind of, there was an actual calendar to right. it and a schedule. And even if you were going up or down or frustrated or, you know, whatever, you at least understood kind of how the system worked. Whereas I do think it certainly feels much more kind of random and kind of chaotic now. And, you know, I think we certainly in this case, I think this, the fact that, you know, the cast that we had back then, who at the time were just kind of the folks that we could call on the phone or call in favors with because we had either worked with them in the past or friends had or something like that, you know, because we kind of got that group of people together very randomly and kind of independently. And then it just so happened that they all went on to, you know, have these great careers and everything. So just having this cast who now had a certain marquee quality or whatever that we could avail ourselves of, you know, certainly helped, you know, keep the idea of that show alive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same was true of just the fact that, you know, with streaming now, it never really went away. You know, once mm-hmm. upon, you know, back in the old days, we would have had two tiny seasons, maybe a DVD that's in a bin somewhere, and then you're just gone. So the fact that, you know, we actually found a life for the show after the show was over, basically, you know, that was certainly very specific to the time that it happened.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I wonder, like, the development process seems like it's part of this too, right? Like, it feels like we sell shows now and development takes 2 years at least. And then by that time, there's a new regime or a new mandate or whatever. I mean, Scott, I feel like Daisy Jones and the Six, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you had your room over 2 years ago. Is that wrong?
The room was over more than 2 years ago. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's true. Well, that was obviously very, you know, COVID related.
And right.
There were a lot of stops and starts along the way. The development process was really seamless. And I'm totally unqualified to talk about kind of the state of the industry of television and anything else. It's my first real kind of foray into it. And also it was always pitched as a limited series. So I'd love nothing more than for them to call and go, we want more of these. And then I, you know, we could talk about it, but like, this was always designed to have a beginning, middle, and an end. But yeah, the last couple of years have been super strange. And definitely when the writer's room ended, we had all of our scripts and then the world changed and we needed to do things with them that we didn't expect. So it definitely was a great education.
What was development like prior to getting the room together?
To sell it, My wife, again, is a ninja, if you haven't been listening to our introductions. And she was very much like, we have a book, but I want you to write the first episode. And I want a little bit of a series sales pitch document that we could sell it with. And so we put that together, and she sent it to Amazon on a Friday and said, you know, we'd had a lunch a little while ago with Amazon. When I say we, it was Hello Sunshine. Yeah. And she sort of hinted that there would be something coming their way, because based on the conversation, it sounded like it would be right up their alley. So she sent it to them on a Friday and said, we expect to hear from you Monday morning with a yes or no before we take it out to the rest of the industry. We got the call on Monday saying we're in, and we'll, you know, what do you want? And that was pretty cool. So is that how it goes all the time? I think
for the most part, yeah.
Yeah. It was,
I think with Lauren, it does. With Lauren, it does.
It was a pretty cool thing to watch. And then we hired a showrunner, Will Graham, and then we put a room together and kind of got to work, which was, that was more of the like normal process, I guess.
It seemed like it was not a terribly unusual process other than getting a fast yes. But Liz, tell Scott what it's really like.
Do I want to hear this? Do I want to live in dreamland?
Listen, since I started working with Lauren, it all goes much smoother, I will say. Wow. But yeah, I mean, it is back to kind of your original question. Like, it is crazy how the landscape has changed. And I mean, I don't want to get too much in the like writer's strike territory, but like, there, you know, it amazes me kind of, not necessarily in a good way, how it feels right now to be in development. And I even feel like it's rare to get to shoot a pilot before you write all the episodes. It feels like it's either doesn't happen or it's straight to series. You don't get the benefit that I think like what John's referring to in like our old school days, like you write a pilot, you go shoot it, you see how the actors, you know, manifested these characters, you see what worked, you see what didn't, and then you start to create your series from there. I think there's a huge element that gets lost in not being able to watch a pilot before you begin the series.
It's interesting when, you know, because I mentioned that I kind of worked in features for a while and had, you know, I had enough success that I earned a living and I was very excited about that, that I, you know, got my, you know, I joined the union, I paid my rent and I did all that as a writer or whatever. And I sold some specs and I got various rewriting jobs, but it was also kind of absurd in the sense that I was making a solid living. Nothing ever got made. I was, you know, I would be like the seventh writer on some project that they'd been grinding on for like 8 years or something like that. It was kind of a surreal existence in that regard. And I actually kind of ended up realizing like, you know, something kind of needed to change when, you know, a spec I had sold was like kind of it was a Civil War train robbery, kind of a, you know, a yarn, kind of a rollicking yarn type of a big action movie or whatever. And that had put me in this category. So I was going up for a lot of that kind of those kind of jobs or whatever. And then there was this moment where every version of those that I was going up for was basically a, you know, a comic book property, which I never read in my whole life. And I realized like, I've got to rethink what I'm doing. And so switching into television was a huge, you know, revelation in the sense that they have to make things. You know, there was this sense that like, if you were on a show, scripts are due, you've got to, you know, production is feverish for their material and all this sort of stuff. So it was an entire different way of living. And it, you know, it certainly taught me an enormous amount. But it was also, there was that regularity to it, you know, whether you were up or down, you know, the machine kept going. And so you either knew you were in or you're out, you were making the show or you weren't, or any things of that nature. That was kind of a very, you know, it had its own ups and downs, but it was definitely a very different lifestyle than what I was doing in features. And I just like last year was having this discussion with my agent who was there when I switched. And he was just like, well, how does it feel to be back in the movie industry? Because that's kind of what it feels like it's shifting back towards, where everything is development, development, development. And they're, you know, especially with like cable and streaming stuff, it seems there is no, you know, there's no feverish, you know, wood chipper that you need to throw stuff into to keep the machine going. So it's a very, it has a different feel and vibe to kind of, you know, how it was to me when I was starting out.
There's so much more ambiguity. Like, it's just like, okay, we're in a writer's room, but is it a writer's room? It's a mini room. What's a mini room? What the fuck is a mini room? Why do these exist? Another topic for another day. But like, okay, so we're like kind of in a room and we might end up working on the show and the show might go, or we might write all the scripts and then the whole thing will be thrown out. Like, it's just, it's so, there's not a lot to like, you know, plant your feet into where you're like, okay, this is a job. This is like a real job that's going to continue, that I know is going to shoot. You know, it's like, it probably is very analogous to what features might feel like. I think now, you know, I think now there are probably TV writers, myself included, that are like, oh, features, like you get hired, you're going to write something, you're never going to go to set, and you're just going to hand it in and be like,
it was pretty strange by the time we got around to making the show, all of the writers had moved on to other things and weren't available to be on set to sort of see their episodes, to pitch new things. And that was a strange kind of thing. That did feel a little bit more like the feature world, where it's like, see you at the premiere, guys.
Yeah. And they've worked on like 8 things since then. And you're kind of, now you're on set essentially doing it, you know, by yourself, maybe with one other person. It has changed so dramatically. And I think there've been great aspects to the changes, but there's also been real downsides. And I think, again, like real financial downsides too.
Yeah. Let me ask you, with these, the uncertainty at every step, you know, there, like you said, there used to be a process we went through to pitch a show, sell a show, get a show picked up, and then actually get on the air. With the uncertainty now that we could write all these scripts and this show still won't go, Liz, I'll throw this to you first, but then I open it to everyone. Like, emotionally, how do you in the room deal with that? How do you feel like anything matters?
Well, that's the thing. I think the system is banking on the fact that writers will care no matter what. So you take away stability, you take away financial incentive, you take away other people. And I think the expectation is that we are going to care enough about our work that we are going to fill that space and we are going to try to do as much as we possibly can. We're going to be the ones to care. You know, you're not going to hand in a script that you don't think is good because you ran out of time. You're going to use every single second of every single day to make it better. And I think that's what people are banking on. I don't think that's a good thing. But I think it's the system kind of banking on that we have enough pride in what we do that we will find a way to do it even with no support, you know?
I mean, you got to show them that what's real. That's crazy. Here, yeah. Care less.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, have no respect.
What's the option?
It's also that you are banking on the fact that just people need opportunity. So you're like, okay, we're not going to give you any guarantees. We're not going to necessarily pick up the show. We're only going to guarantee you 10 weeks of work. We're going to pay you scale. Everybody's equal, you know, all these things. But what they're going to bank on is that writers will say like, but I want to be on that show and I want a job. And if this is the only way I can work, then I guess I'm going to have to take it. But anyway, this is all, again, this all gets into like, what will.
So bleak. What, everything yeah, is, like, oh what, gosh.
Yeah. It's, well, but it's, I mean, the hopeful part, I guess, is that we all have these stories to tell. We all have this passion. Party Down's a great example. Like, you know, 12 years later, 10 years later, however much time it's been, like John is coming back with the same passion and knowledge and wisdom and stories and cast to have done it all again, you know? And I think there's like a hopefulness and a resilience to, we want to write, we want to tell stories. That's what we do. And we're going to do it in all circumstances. Not all circumstances are fair.
Yeah. I want to circle back to this, and I'm sure like it's, this, these are conversations we can't get away from anyway, because this is what we all deal with on the day to day. But I want to ask, Scott, having been in features for so long, have you seen that industry change in the past couple of years in the way that TV has? Is it harder or easier than when you started?
I don't know that it's been, well, the thing that I would say is that I'm terrified that the movies that I like to write and see are going away.
Yeah.
That there's going to be nothing but very big budget movies, maybe some horror stuff. And then occasionally, you know, maybe a streamer will make a tiny movie, but that'll be the extent of our opportunities to see features in movie theaters. And that's a bummer. And it's definitely a concern. Every time someone says this is the end and it's over, something comes along to prove that it's not the case. So I am hopeful that it'll circle back to, there'll be some passion and a desire to see these kinds of, you know, middle budget movies. Mm-hmm. But I think it remains to be seen if there's an audience for it that will still go to the theaters to see them.
Yeah, I mean, right. That's the big question, right? Is theatrical releases and all that.
Yeah. But which when I write, I want to go to the movies and I want to watch these things with other people and I want to have that experience. I grew up, you know, going to the movies three times a week, and I probably have gone twice in a year, and it's horrible. And I wish it wasn't the case. And I don't want it to go away. I really don't. I feel bad that my kids haven't been able to experience that same kind of thing that I love so much.
That's interesting. And then the other thing I kind of wanted to cover is this idea of original series, you know, like, John, it feels like you got in at a good time with Party Down, where you guys could, and we talked about this years and years ago, and I would urge people to go check out that episode of the podcast, but like, you basically made your own little pilot and showed the people what this could be. Mm-hmm. That feels like a good way to get an original idea across. In the past few years before, you know, you started on this new season of Party Down, what had been your experience in like pitching new projects?
I mean, pretty standard fare in the sense that, you know, we definitely pitched things. We sold some things. We, you know, went through the pilot, you know, we went through all the, you know, usual development, this and that. And, you know, and usually the result was, you know, a polite pass or, you know, things of that nature. So, you know, I had, you know, worked on other shows and things like that. And it's also, you know, Party Down is kind of a, you know, it's a bit of a mixed blessing. I mean, not super mixed, because it, you know, absolutely is a miraculous thing that has happened and that's been very good for me. You know, the one thing nobody has ever asked, even when they say that they love the show or anything, is, would you like to do something like that for us? Because mm-hmm. I think it's just like, it definitely was its own weird little thing that just happened. You know, we kind of lucked into that spot. And, you know, it's a thing that I have, you know, said to my people or whatever, been like, you know, who's the new stars circa 2009? What can we pitch to them? Because I really loved living in that, like, little corner where you can just kind of, you know, I'm not a big budget person. I like things to be just kind of a scruffy little thing or whatever. And it's a great way to work, because usually there's nobody looking over your shoulder. You're not in, you know, these epic battles with, you know, somebody else's vision or anything like that. So I was like, immediately, I was like, let's do that again. But they're like, there is none. It's all gone, you know, everything's a brand now.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sadly just what the landscape looks like. So, you know, it it certainly made a difference in kind of, you know, my career, in that, you know, it's easier to sort of talk to people about things or whatever, but it definitely hasn't, you know, changed just the basic reality that, you know, most of the stuff that you go in with, especially if you are trying to do some weird little thing or whatever, you know, you're always going kind of against the odds.
Yeah. I mean, I think something you all have in common is, you know, there are no superheroes. Like, you're all doing these sort of small personal stories, often about young people, or, you know, like, just no explosions, right? They're non-genre stories. And I wonder about, like, how do we get to make these? How do we get to continue making these? Is there a place for these? I mean, Liz, the last time we talked was around Little Fires Everywhere. And so you've now done two sort of best-selling book adaptations, right? But before that, we look at Life Unexpected, and we talked during Casual, which was the smallest show, but was such a good show. Yeah. Like, how do you find a way forward? How do you keep telling the kinds of stories you want to tell?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, I think to what Scott was saying about how features have evolved, it's been interesting in my, you know, I mean, I don't want to say it's like been 20 years of doing this, you know, thankfully and luckily. And it used to be like, you know, you could write an hour drama that was just, you know, people talking about the complications of being people, you know, and having to interact with each other and do things. And then I feel like it changed to, okay, they can say I love you, but it needs to be like on a bridge that's like exploding while, you know, a murder is coming after them and an asteroid's hitting. And you're just like, okay, it's like bigger and bigger. And then you start to say, like, well, where are the stories where people can just be like, I love you, I hate you, I'm overwhelmed, I, you know, whatever it is. And then it starts to move to like that half hour drama. I mean, that was really how I found my way to Casual, was like, where do I fit where it's just kind of quirky people trying to navigate just like the normal world. And I think it keeps evolving. I mean, I hope people, you know, I think stories can certainly be framed in different ways. Some things hit down the middle with more of a mass appeal. You know, I think Little Fires had that mass appeal. I mean, because of Celeste Book, because of Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. But I also think it had a surprising subversiveness to it. So, you know, it's like, how do you do it? How do you kind of have that mainstream appeal, but how are you kind of doing something maybe a little less straight down the middle, a little more subversive, a little left of center, however you want to kind of think about it. So that's what I try to think about. And I mean, personally, I love doing adaptations. These are authors I idolize and admire. I mean, Celeste was, I felt so connected to that book the minute Lauren Neustetter said I had 48 hours to read it. I just felt like I'd been waiting a decade since Life Unexpected for it. And then Cheryl Strayed is like another person just off the charts. I mean, I've been reading Cheryl, you know, since Wild, but also her work before Wild. And, you know, approaching that show, it's like, okay, well, now how do I honor what this is? This is a left of center show. This isn't necessarily straight down the middle, but like Little Fires, it's grappling with what it means to be a mother, what it means to be a daughter, what it means to exist in this world, what it means to exist in a world without the person who you want to exist most with. Like, these are all just real human life questions. And so, you know, of course there's a question of like, how do you frame it to bring as many people to it as possible? But I mean, you want to keep telling those stories.
Yeah. Did you have to frame it to sell it to the studio or network?
Yeah, we certainly had a pitch. And, you know, the pitch had a lot of humor to it. I think, you know, would you call it a comedy? I wouldn't. I don't know how people necessarily kind of heard it in their minds, but dramedy, I don't know. I think it's a show about really sad things with a whole lot of hope. You know, I mean, and that's life. And that's what we just lived for 3 years. I mean, really sad things with everything we hold dear, practically taken away, with a whole lot of hope that we could get to the other side. And so, yeah, I don't know.
It makes sense. Well, I look forward to the show. I mean, listen, I think when people hire you also, they you have a point of view. You have, you know, a certain tone in the shows that you run and write. And I think it can go into drama a little more. It can go a little into comedy a little more. But either way, like we know what we're getting from one of your shows.
Yeah, no, I hope. And I mean, to what John was saying too, you know, whether you call it kind of scruffiness or scrappiness, you know, I think what was so fun to me about doing Tiny Beautiful Things in particular, and is like anytime you are expanding yourself out from, you know, whatever kind of mold box you fit in last time, you know, it's like, how are we, how do we have the freedom to push the edges of our work, to not be so linear, to take more chances, to allow us to trust that the audience is smart enough to keep up, and maybe even ahead of us in some ways. And I think it's so, it is exciting when you carve out like a little nook and cranny where you can be more experimental and do those things. And like John, you start to have to look harder for those like little corners, you know?
I want to ask about that pushing at the edges of your work, because I think that's really interesting. And it's surely something that we all do as we get older and more experienced as writers. And Scott, I wanted to throw this to you and ask about Daisy Jones specifically. Like, how is this very much your show, like a show that could come from you, but also how is it different to what you've done before?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, I mean, like Liz said, I really do love adaptations as well, because when I read something, I get to be a fan and just fall in love with something the way I would if I had nothing to do with it. And then I read this book and kind of flipped forward to such a degree that it was kind of like, I can't let anyone else do it. I have to do it. What's cool about it is that it's an oral history. So it's people reflecting on their lives and telling us the story of like how they felt when something happened without kind of going into too much detail about what actually happened. And it would be up to us, all the writers, to actually write the scenes of the moments that they're talking about, which really don't exist in full in a book like they usually do. And so that was a really fun kind of experience, because there's so much opportunity for invention without kind of deviating too much from the sandbox.
And
we just had a great time with that, and it was one of those situations where all of my experiences in features, and you know, I would have such an easier time getting this through probably as a two-hour movie, but I thought that would shortchange everything about the project to such a degree, because when I read it, I just wanted to live in this place and be around these people and spend as much time with them as possible, and it was definitely longer than 90 minutes. So, you know, I think initially I was like, let's do a 13-hour version of this. And they're like, I don't know what that is. But really just having the opportunity to kind of go as far down the road as possible with something that hopefully the book readers will really still appreciate and love and recognize, and then build upon it a lot of new stuff that I think maybe they won't see coming.
Yeah. Did you have to make a case? I mean, granted, like your pitch to pick up was pretty quick, but did you have to make a case for this existing as a TV show?
I had to make a case initially to Taylor, who wrote the novel. Taylor was thinking about it as a movie, or there were some discussions about, you know, let's make this a feature film. A Star Is Born, I think, was in production, and you know, that, you know, music stuff, maybe that would work and we could sell it as a movie. And I kind of said the same thing that I just said to you guys, which is like, I don't want to do that. The 2-hour version of this is just cliff notes. It's just, here's all the things that happened in this band, and it's the rise and fall and whatever. And the book is so much more nuanced than that. The characters are just so much richer. I've never done this before, but I would love the opportunity to spend as much time as possible with all these people. I want them to be my friends. I mean, that's the thing I love about television, is that by the end of it, you just really feel like you know everybody so well, and you're in that world. And yeah, that was just something that I happily convinced her that was the right approach.
Yeah, that makes sense. And John, similarly, this idea of, you know, pushing at the edges of what you've done before, was there a different approach to this new season of Party Down than previous seasons?
I mean, honestly, not really, because we really thought about it as just like, oh, we just get to do a third season. It just happens to be 12 years later. Cause we didn't, you know, I think, you know, in the back of our minds, our worst nightmare is that we just take this thing that, you know, I think we're all proud of and happy with and have very fond memories of, that we just fuck it up. And then all of a sudden, like, all our goodwill evaporates and people are mad at us and we're mad at ourselves. So, you know, we wanted to not do that, certainly. So we didn't go into it with any notion other than we wanted to basically just, you know, pick up as if the show had been going this whole time. And it was 12 years later, everyone's 12 years older, their lives had been flowing along, you know, while the camera was turned off, and then we just see where they're at. And so that the show is the same, but it's just the people and the circumstances have evolved. Mm-hmm. But that was also just very much a deliberate decision on our part. So anything that was new or different was just that we have new people in there, you know, the themes have shifted around a bit and everything, but we still want it to feel like the same show very much. So we weren't trying to kind of reinvent it or, you know, get weird or anything of that nature. So it certainly, you know, it feels a little different just because, you know, of everything just described, there's more people in there. So there's just more going on. It isn't a, you know, quite as, you know, hangouty or whatever as the, you know, earlier version, just because you're kind of having to check in what everyone's up to and all that kind of stuff. And doing six episodes almost demanded kind of a bit more of a serialized, you know, arc to it or whatever. That was, you know, a new experience for us. But I think, you know, our overriding thing was we wanted to be, you know, true to the spirit of what we originally set out to do and not kind of just tip over the apple cart, just the hell of it or anything.
Absolutely.
Like that. Our anxiety was, you know, certainly in the background all the time.
Well, that's something I want to ask about, because I do get asked by a lot of new writers about trusting your decisions and how do you know when you've made the right decision for your story, for your characters. And so, like, John, revisiting these characters, picking them up in their lives 12 years later, while you didn't necessarily want to make big swings, you still had to make choices. Mm-hmm. And so tell me about, like, feeling confident in those choices about their current directions that would play over these six episodes.
Well, it was interesting because we certainly talked about it, but I don't think, you know, because we originally developed the show kind of a group of us, because we all kind of shared kind of comic sensibilities and we were into some of the same stuff, and we were kind of, but this being Rob Thomas, our other producer, Dan Etheridge, and Paul Rudd. And so we originally kind of came up with the idea for the show, just kicking around the things that we were interested in and our desire to try and do something that wasn't what was at the time kind of what we thought was the standard for, you know, comedy, which was more of, you know, multicam kind of, you know, setup, payoff, you know, that kind of style of comedy writing or whatever. So we spent a lot of time, like literally years, kind of thinking about it, evolving this idea, talking about these characters, doing all this stuff to kind of get to the point where we actually went out to start pitching it around and doing all this sort of stuff. So we had lived with it for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, wrote two seasons of it, which, you know, by finally being able to kind of get the actors involved. This is the first time that I'd ever worked. You know, we didn't have, it was a weird show because we didn't have a writer's room. There was no budget for a writer's room, and there was only a budget for, you know, the reason I ended up running it was because there was basically no producer fees or anything on the show. So the only way to make a living on the show was the script fees. And so, you know, Rob actually got another show at the same time. So they're like, you know what, this, you go do that, we'll go do this. So for me, it meant I also was deeply immersed in this for, you know, 2 years straight or whatever. So that part never, you know, everybody and the actors, you know, they absolutely evolved these characters as we went along and everything. So everybody knew, you know, there was never, you know, a stutter step getting back up and running or whatever. It was actually pretty easy to get back into writing the show. And, you know, I think the only thing that was tough in that regard was, again, just like the logistics of squishing new people in there, figuring out how to, you know, do this or that or whatever. But I don't think, you know, in terms of going back to something, you know, we never stopped thinking about it. So that was, you know, that was the easy part. And, you know, even going back to what we were talking about before, it was one of the great luxuries of the show was that we had, you know, you learn so much by making the show, seeing it up on its feet, seeing people say the words and all that sort of stuff. And there's really no substitute for that for me, certainly. And so that, you know, made a huge difference in like just kind of how, like reflexively, you could actually just sit down and write the show. Or, you know, if you, you know, break a, you know, when you realize a scene works, where you're just like, oh yeah, these guys in that, that's, yeah, forget it, that's done. You know, things like that. So, you know, that, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I feel like, you know, whenever they'll give us a chance, we'll happily run back and do some more, just because all those muscles are still there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so, yeah, so that's one of the things that I, you know, I do feel like it's much harder in this new landscape. You know, when you talked about the idea of like, you don't make a pilot and then decide if you're doing the show anymore. But you learn so much about what the show is in making the pilot. You know, that's definitely something that, you know, I miss personally.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, similarly, Liz and Scott, as you're working on adaptations, you know, TV is a different animal from a book. And so you have to make choices. And so tell me about trusting those choices, especially in the pilot phase when you're not necessarily working with a room.
Yeah, I mean, I think you obviously have producers in place to, you know, gut check you. But I think that it really comes down to like your connection with the material and having to do a really brave thing, which is trusting your gut. You know, I can think of an example on Little Fires. I really wanted to change the ending because I didn't want to change the emotion around the ending or the thematic meaning of the ending, which is that this character, Izzy, burns the house. Like in the book, this character, Izzy, the youngest daughter, burns the house down. And I felt like you kind of knew it at the beginning. And so it works in a book, but for a TV show, especially coming off, say, like a Big Little Lies, not that I was on that, but that being in the zeitgeist, yeah. I just felt like I didn't want to be repetitive to like, oh, the person who seems like it should be, it rightfully is. I wanted to change the ending. And that's a big thing to do in a successful book. And even pitching the ending to the writers on the first day, I could tell they were all like, that sounds crazy. And I'm like, I know this sounds crazy, but like, I think we could do it. And so then we spent like a week being like, but what if it wasn't that idea? What if it was like this person or this person or this person or that? We literally went around a circle, everybody that it could be. And finally, I was like, you know, you get insecure and voices get into your head and it gets hard to trust your gut because you're like, maybe I'm insane. But you start to just like, you have to trust it. And so I would say, let's move in this direction. And if it becomes like untenable, unbearable, if it just seems like it can never work, we have the luxury of being able to deviate. You know, we're writers, we write something different. But like, let's just try to move in this direction and see how it feels. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And as we tried to move, we found our way to it. And so when I see the ending, I'm like, yeah, she did burn down the house, but she lit a, you know, she had the thought, somebody else did it. But at the end of the day, it's Reese Witherspoon who burnt down that house in a way. And oh, that was the bad, that was actually the first bad idea I had. I was like, what if Reese burned the house down? And they were like, adult people don't burn down houses metaphorically, you know? And it was like, okay, no, you're right. But like, what if you traced it back to, it is her fault. And even though she didn't pour the gas, even though she didn't light the match, what if, when you step back, you're like, you didn't do it, but you did it, you know? And how does that feel? And so it kind of was that like Into the Woods take of like, no, it's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. Well, it's kind of all our faults. This is systemic. So anyway, I think you do get to this place where at the end of the day, I mean, and I don't know, you know, Scott, if you had this experience, John, if you had, I remember on my very first show, running it, being up at the board on Life Unexpected, and Josh Reams is a writer that I've worked with for years. He's kindly hired me from being a baby writer when I was, you know, didn't know the rules and drove everybody crazy, and really mentored me and guided me. And I remember calling him after like the first couple of weeks in the writer's room. And I was like, I don't know. I'm like standing up at the board and they're all just like staring at me and they're just like waiting for like, what do I have to do? Like think of it all myself. You know, I was just having this panic. And he goes, yeah, you got to think of it all yourself. And if anybody helps you, that's a bonus. But you do not look out to that room of people and think that they're going to all solve it for you. Like you invited them here. You're hosting this party. Like you're providing the food and drinks. You're making sure people get home safely. Like this is on you. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is on me. So you have to, you have to kind of dig deep and start to be like, well, if this is on me, if I at the end of the day only have myself, because it's my responsibility, because I did this, then I got to learn to trust my gut and I have to go with it. And so it becomes scary because once you do that, you put it out in the world and you're like, oh no, are people going to like my gut? You're like, what if people don't like my gut? You know, but you have to, what else can you trust? You know, you're never going to be happy doing something, not having trusted your own instincts. So you become the barometer. And I think it takes a lot of bravery to be that person. And I think, you know, when anybody tries it and does it, like, you know, people can be so quick to rip things apart, but I think it is worth celebrating. I think it's brave.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
Go ahead, Ben. I was just going to say, I was so green at this that I thought that a writer's room is like 12 angry men. Like you have to have consensus before you move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And so like, there's all these people in the room and like two or three of them aren't convinced that that's the right thing. So for me, I was like, no, let's keep talking. We got to fix this. We got to all agree. And eventually Will Graham, who would show run Mozart in the Jungle, he pulls me aside and he goes, you know, this is not how this is going to work. We'll never get anywhere. We're never going to get consensus with all these people. If you have a majority, it's a bonus. But at the end of the day, it's whatever we want to do. We have to, you know, we have to be the decision makers or this is going to be chaos. So that was very helpful to learn.
That's true.
It was very illustrative that, you know, coming off of Party Down where I had all this, you know, confidence in what we were doing because we'd lived in it for so long and we knew it left, right and sideways and everything. The next thing I did after that was, you know, I kind of bumbled straight into like a network show that, you know, went straight to pilot and then magically went on the air to, you know, I was very surprised that this happened. But all that happened in a totally different style, in the sense that I went into it without that confidence, without that sense of like, I know this inside and out and nobody can tell me what it is. And I can tell everyone what it is. And I just got murdered. Like between, you know, what you guys are just describing with the writer's room but also in, you know, facing off with all the various, you know, executives who might have a different idea of what they think the show should be and all that sort of stuff. You know, there's a lot of you know, not just trusting your gut, like you say, but also being willing to fight for it, or just say, no, this is what it is, as opposed to kind of trying to sort of negotiate your way to something where everyone's happy. Yeah. Because, you know, I don't think that leads to a good place in any circumstances, just because, you know, you do have to be like, this is, you know, you have to figure out, like, you know, this is what it needs to be, and we're going to make that work. And, you know, we can all sort of pitch in and make this work, you know, following this idea, or, you know, it can all kind of get nibbled into bits from all different directions and go nowhere. And, you know, I've certainly experienced both. So I prefer the former. Definitely.
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, like, even my experience at the beginning of Tiny Beautiful Things, I was so obviously, like, and still am, so enamored with Cheryl. I mean, she's one of my favorite, you know, Cheryl talks about carrying around a suitcase with all her favorite writers in it. And I'm like, if I was carrying around a suitcase, it would be Cheryl Strayed. Like, it would be either her books or just Cheryl Strayed in my suitcase. And I had this feeling of, like, you know, it was so important to Reese and Laura Dern and Cheryl. And I came on and I felt this feeling of, like, well, tell me what you want. Like, I just want to make you happy. You know, tell me what you want me to do. And it took a little while to start internalizing it for myself. You know, you can't defensively write. You can really only be on the offense. And so until you internalize it and connect to it, like, you don't have a gut instinct when you're just trying to kind of please. And when you're so like, well, you tell me, I just want to make you happy. It's like, you have to really connect in this, like, deeper way to start to feel, like, for me, I have to, like, start to feel it inside my body. And then I can start to own it. And then I can start to have not only perspective, but, like, an opinion. But it can be, you know, it doesn't always, it's probably like a child. Like, sometimes you love them as soon as they come out. And sometimes you're like, I don't know, it took a couple days or maybe a couple weeks. Like, I don't know. maybe that's a weird analogy.
Liz, you could tell us, even as you were talking about changing the ending of Little Fires Everywhere, that, like, that was a choice that got you excited. Yeah. You know, like, and it still got you excited even to talk about it in retrospect. And yeah. Scott, the same thing in talking about Daisy Jones, like, you didn't want anyone else to write this because you knew how to do it. You knew the choices that needed to be made in this. And I think there's something to that, like, making the choices that excite you, right?
Yeah.
And you never know all of them. I think you know most of them. Yeah. You know some of them. I think going in with complete confidence feels like it's a tall order, but it's great to definitely have a little bit of a barometer to be like, that doesn't feel right. I'm the OG super fan of this, and I feel like if we're now over here, we're just too far removed from the thing that I love, and let's get back to that. I mean, I always sort of felt like the book provided that for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I do think that, like, that's such a good, you know, when you're adapting something, there's this core to go back to. Mm-hmm. And I think that is such a great way to have a gut check. You're not in it alone with your gut. You have these tent poles, and you have these guideposts, and you have your own fandom and what made you fall in love with it and what made you connect to it. And, you know, it is this thing that's bigger than yourself in a great way.
Yeah. Absolutely. We are going to leave it there. We're going to wrap up, as we always do, by asking what you are watching on television. But first, let's get the plugs. John, Party Down is back. Tell us the premiere date and where to find it.
The premiere date is... today? It's tomorrow.
No one knows.
It's tomorrow, February 24th on Stars. So in the future, right? That's when we're speaking to people.
Yes.
So have watched it is what I will suggest.
And I think this will be out. There will still be, it's a weekly release, right? So we'll still get.
Yes. So there's six episodes. So we've got 6 weeks.
Great.
To dig around in.
And you know, I speak for everyone when I say I'm excited to see these characters on screen again.
Oh, thank you. No, we were super excited ourselves. So we're thrilled that it's out there.
Good. And Scott, Daisy Jones and the Six, what's the premiere date and where do I find it?
Daisy Jones and the Six premieres on Amazon Prime, 3 episodes on March the 3rd.
Great.
And then another 3 the following week, and then 2 more after that, and then 2 more in the end. So we're trying to keep you guys talking in the month of March.
That is a ridiculous release schedule, and yeah. I look forward to watching it.
It's a very, it's like, it's a musical. There's, you'll see why it is. It's okay. Everything is very, very musical, and it's, they're like movements. And I hope that, I hope people will enjoy the awkward cadence.
Yeah, everyone I know is really excited for the show. I'm really excited for the show, not having read the book, but everyone who read the book is so excited to see what you all did with it. And I'm sure it's going to be great. Liz, Tiny Beautiful Things. When do we watch it? Where do we watch it?
You can watch Tiny Beautiful Things April 7th on Hulu. They're 8 half-hour episodes. They all drop at once. So you can just like settle in for a couple hours and enjoy.
Yeah, it's a nice weekend for everyone.
Nice weekend. Yeah. Go for it.
Terrific.
I've seen some of it and it's great.
Oh, good.
Oh, and I get to watch Daisy Jones tonight. I'm so excited. I'm seeing 2 episodes tonight. I loved the trailer. I cannot wait.
The trailer is great.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's going to be so good.
The trailer is insane. Show. It's insane.
Let me ask you what you all are watching TV. What's getting you excited or inspired these days? What are you talking about with your friends, your loved ones? And John, let's start with you.
I mean, in the world of what I'm talking about with my friends and loved ones, mostly my wife in these circumstances, Krunk on Earth, I'm very into, and I'm kind of just, I don't know what it is, but it's it's funny and mesmerizing. And that, I'm forgetting the actress's name, but she's fantastic. And I think I just, you know, I love that just kind of, you know, I'm very interested in kind of nonsense disguised as sense. And so it really scratches an itch for me. And then the thing that I don't, you know, I don't talk to anybody about is like my weird comfort rewatching of the DVD extras on the Lord of the Rings extended editions. Just because, I don't know, I think I always fantasized about, you know, the filmmaking process, and they just drive me crazy.
That's great. And I will say what I didn't say to you all before we started, which is usually part of my pre-recording ramble, is the listeners of this podcast are the kinds of people who watch DVD extras. And so like, this is what we want, right? Like we want to see that behind the scenes, how did it get made?
10-foot puppet going by or whatever, you know, I can't get enough. So yeah, that's like my secret, like comfort viewing or whatever.
I love it. Scott, what are you watching these days?
Have you guys watched, the thing that I cannot stop talking about and telling everybody about is the Ethan Hawke documentary about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward that is on, I think, HBO Max now.
Yeah.
It's called The Last Movie Stars. It is the greatest, like, mini, I guess it's a documentary series. It's a couple episodes. I've watched it like 3 times now because I just keep learning new things. And it's like this amazing depiction of this family and this marriage. And obviously Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward are like the coolest. But then there's this whole other aspect of it where Ethan Hawke kind of goes into the psychology of acting and actors. And at one point, Vincent D'Onofrio like shows you into the Zoom lens what method acting looks like. And it like blew my mind how good that guy was. And but it is such a special thing. And I'm probably gonna watch it again as soon as we're done.
That's great. We started it and this is what's going to make me finish it. That was great.
It's so awesome.
Liz, what are you watching?
Okay, my things that I'm watching are linked by Mike White fandom and love. Obviously, White Lotus. Everybody's watching White Lotus. But with my 7.5-year-old son and wife, we have started at the beginning of 2000 Survivor. We've basically gone back to season 1. I bought Paramount Plus just for this. And we are slowly making our way. We will get to the Mike White season. We're not there yet.
It'll take you years.
We'll feel very satisfying. We are 9 seasons in. And it's been awesome. It's been such an amazing lesson it's been shocking what was even allowed 10 years ago. But looking at like 20 years ago, it's just been this like experiment. And there have been so many things to talk about where we're like, whoa, okay. No, like that will not fly. No one can be walking around naked, rubbing up on people, like none of that. Or, you know, it's been fascinating. You know, why is Jeff Probst shaming the woman? And it's like, well, there you go. Good question. He didn't do anything wrong, you know, whatever it is, but it's been really, really fun to watch. So, you know, I don't know. I've watched every episode of Survivor and now I'm watching every episode twice. I don't know.
Love it. I will recommend to you and your family, check out the interview I did with Jeff Probst. I want to say 10 years ago, something like that.
Oh my God.
It is my favorite episode of this podcast. I was excited to talk to him.
I have to do that. My 10-year-old. My 10-year-old saw Jeff Probst. We were on vacation Thanksgiving and he saw Jeff Probst at a table and he lost his mind and he was like, what do I do? And I was like, you know, if you're a fan, just, you know, you can go over and just sort of say hi. So he walked his sister over. And he introduced himself to Jeff, and Jeff could not have been nicer. And they come back, and all the while I'm looking over and I'm realizing that Jeff Probst is sitting next to Dave Grohl.
Oh my God.
And I was like, Michael, one day you're going to appreciate that you went over to Jeff Probst and you didn't see the guy he was with, and you didn't recognize the guy that he was with, because that would be an even cooler story.
That's amazing.
He has no idea who Dave Grohl is, but one day he will.
That is amazing. We're getting for our son's 8th birthday, we're going to get him a cameo from Jeff. We're going to like go into the deep.
Oh my God.
Cameo, like,
he was the nicest dude ever. He was so nice to them.
Mm. Oh man. Well, I just want to throw this out because I've never watched any reality television at all. And just in when you brought up the idea of things that we're actually talking about, mm-hmm. I don't think there's actually anything that I talked about more, I think, because of the fact that I don't watch any reality television, and I really had to grapple with Paul T. Goodman, which I thought was incredible, but also just like I never stopped trying to figure out what I was actually watching and thinking while I watched it.
Yes, which feels like the goal of the show.
Oh yeah, no, and it was amazing in that regard, because I do get very nervous around reality television type stuff in terms of who's doing what to whom and who's controlling the narrative and all this sort of stuff. And the fact that they just made an insane meal of that in this was crazy. No, it was amazing. That was definitely something not only that we devoured, but also we never stopped talking about.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. We'll try it, and we'll get Jason in here to talk about it at some point, because I'm dying to hear about how that show was put together. All right. Thank you all so much for being here. Congrats on the new projects. We're so excited to see them. It's good to see you all again and catch up again. The tribe has spoken.
Thanks.
Yes. Thanks, Ben. Oh my God.
Forever. Dog. This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.